University of Colorado.
Welcome to See You on the Air, the University of Colorado's podcast. We feature faculty from across CU's four campuses and their interesting, innovative, and sometimes life-changing work.
I take it as my job as a horror writer to always go one more step into the darkness than the reader would go his or herself. The difference in terror and dread is sitting on the couch waiting for someone to knock at the door. Terror is opening the door and seeing who they are. And fiction gets a lot more mileage out of sitting on the couch and waiting for that door to knock.
Welcome to CU on the Air. We're talking today with Professor Stephen Graham Jones, who's a CU Boulder professor and author of experimental fiction, horror fiction, crime fiction, and science fiction. He's renowned for applying more literary stylings to a variety of genres, as well as already having published 20 books before he turned age 50. He also has nearly 300 short stories published, from literary journals to truck enthusiast magazines, from textbooks to anthologies to best of the year annuals. Jones has won the Texas Institute for Letters Award, National Endowment for the Arts Fellow in Fiction, the Bram Stoker Award for This Is Horror Awards, and his work has been named one of Bloody Disgusting's top 10 horror novels of the year. That last one must make you particularly proud, Professor. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I've got to be honest with you. I'm a big mystery fan, and other than a brief flirtation with Stephen King in my teens and 20s, I haven't read much horror fiction, so maybe you can talk to me about what's the appeal?
The appeal is, I think, the roller coaster, the up and down of horror fiction. It pulls you to scary places, it lets you laugh, it really just lets you release your emotions in a safe, positive way, I feel.
A lot of people love to watch horror films, and that's, of course, gets a lot of attention around Halloween, but a lot of horror films come out in the winter. Why is that?
I guess because there's less daylight hours in winter, and we usually watch movies at night, and it's just a scarier time. In the summer, you want to be out playing. In the spring, you want to be out hiking. But in the winter, you want to curl up and put a DVD in and scare yourself.
And you've taught some horror fiction classes up at the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park. Tell us about that experience.
Oh, I have. And I got to stay in room 217. Had some students bail early in the week because they got too scared just from being at the Stanley, which was neat. And they give us special haunted tours. And we watch scary movies, and we have scary discussions, and we're reading scary books. It's a good time, and I think the students come away with a lot broader, deeper knowledge of horror than they went in.
Why do you think some people really gravitate toward horror and others avoid it like the plague?
You know what most horror fans will tell you? Almost to a person, they say, I saw Exorcist too young, you know, and that programmed them, that conditioned them in some way. I mean, I guess the corollary to that is, what's the right age to see Exorcist, of course? You know, I don't know if there is a right age to see it. But, you know, Stephen King, the way he answers this question sometimes is, he says some people are just wired for horror. And I think some people prefer to ride that roller coaster that has that scary precipitous drop at the center of the amusement park. And some people prefer to take the slow train around the edge of the park. And neither of them are better or worse. It's just different tastes.
Tell us a little bit about some of your other fiction, your science fiction work.
With science fiction, for me, what's tricky is always keeping it from becoming horror in space. So, I mean, you can completely do that. You know, Ridley Scott did it with Alien, and people have been doing it ever since and before him, of course. But I love science fiction. Most of my pleasure reading is science journals and nonfiction popular science. And I love to get to explore ideas in that same way that Clark and Asimov and Bradbury were like exploring a premise and dramatizing an idea.
Again, I'm a fan of crime fiction, so I can really see the appeal of that. What's the appeal for you?
I love that crime fiction, I feel, shows us who we really are, or it shows us who we are when our back's to the wall. I've had a few crime fiction novels published, and to tell you the truth, I like writing them just as much as I like writing horror, because with crime fiction, you generally have to know who done it or who's doing it in the first place before you start, and so you can space out the clues, the reveals, all of that stuff, and it's really a pleasurable experience both to write and to read crime fiction.
And you write experimental fiction. What is that?
You know, there's a writer, Brian Evanson. He also gets, I guess, accused of writing experimental fiction. And his comeback to that is always, I'm not experimenting, I know what I'm doing, you know, which I think makes a lot of sense. A lot of people will interchange experimental with innovative, and I kind of prefer innovative as well, because what innovation is on the page is you have a story that needs to get from, it goes from A, B, C, and it's going to go through the alphabet, say. And innovation is a way of getting from D all the way to J without processing through all those other letters. You come up with a different format or a different style, a different delivery method, and the trick is keeping it intelligible to the reader. That's what you always have to think of first, to not leave the reader behind.
Other than your own work, what would be a piece of experimental fiction that listeners would recognize?
Probably Jonathan Safran Foer's Everything is Illuminated. He has a lot of different modes of delivery in that novel, and they all feel like they're coming from the character or coming from the story. They don't feel like it's just a writer showing off his or her muscle. It's organic to the piece, and that's the trick. You've got to make it feel organic to the piece. It can't feel like something you're stenciling onto the piece.
So how do you, as an author and a university professor, tap into what elicits fear and intrigue in the audiences?
If I'm not scaring myself, then I probably can't scare anybody else, and I do scare myself. It could be that I have a low threshold. I get scared quite easily. A lot of horror authors I talk to say they no longer get scared because they understand the mechanisms now. They understand the tricks. It's all parlor games. It's never turned into that for me. I often write in order to divest myself of what I consider to be scary images or terrifying ideas, but what I find is that when I put them on the page, that just gives them more detail, makes them more real. As for how I tap into that, I take it as my job as a horror writer to always go one more step into the darkness than the reader would go his or herself. They're paying $1 or $25 or whatever it is to engage this story I've written, and because of that, I'm beholden to walk out past where I'm comfortable walking and take them with me and then blow the candle out.
If you scare yourself when you're writing, well, what are your writing habits? You write at night? You write daily?
I write daily, and, you know, I have a wife, family, job, broken cars, dogs needs walking, all the usual life stuff we all have.
That's a bit of a horror.
It can be, for sure. And, you know, when the Harry Potter novels were coming out, when they were reaching, like, full steam, like, probably about Goblet of Fire, number 4, when that book came out, I was there at midnight to get it, and the next day, I was standing in line at the bank reading it. I had it in my lap at the traffic light reading it. I was walking on the sidewalk reading it. It was occupying my mind 24/7. When I'm writing a novel or a story, that's the depth I like to engage it as well. I like to steal every 5 and 10 minute spot I can throughout the day and just scribble down another paragraph and scribble down another paragraph. It's rare that I get a 5-hour writing session, which is probably good because I'm really only good for about 90 minutes. And then I'm just shoveling nothing.
So I'd imagine a number of our listeners are interested in writing. What tips would you give them about building suspense, about writing horror?
On the page, dread is going to be your friend more than terror. Terror works really good at the Cineplex, the jump scares. But dread is that long, slow ramp up to a spike of terror. And the difference in terror and dread is sitting on the couch waiting for someone to knock at the door. Terror is opening the door and seeing who they are. And fiction gets a lot more mileage out of sitting on the couch and waiting for that door to knock.
Horror has been a genre of fiction for a long time, and a lot of the stories seem to have similar themes. You know, there's been vampire stories and werewolf stories throughout the centuries. How have they evolved over that time?
You know, when the werewolf story first started really getting popular, or going viral, I guess we'd call it, probably back around the 15th, 16th century, it was being used differently than when we use it now. Back then, what would happen was different lords would battle and ravage the countryside, burn all the crops, kill all the cattle, leave the people living out there starving. And so a certain small percentage of those people would turn to attacking people on the roadways in order to eat, and they would eat those people sometimes. They would say when they were caught, it wasn't me, I'm a werewolf, I'm not responsible for my actions. And so nowadays we would call them serial killers. Back then, you could like put on a werewolf shroud and hide behind that. You still got punished, but you weren't the same kind of guilty, I don't think. Whereas nowadays, the werewolf stories we tell ourselves have more to do with the fact that we live in a world that's so sterilized and lit up that we need prompting and reminding that we have animal urges inside of us that we need to let run every once in a while.
Why the zombie love for you and your audiences?
The zombie, for the past, 16 years, I guess, has really been a big, blank, metaphoric space we can pour our anxieties into. The zombie right now is warning us about limited resources and overpopulation, how fast an infection can pass from person to person. That's how horror generally works. We pack all our fears and concerns into it. And the zombie has been really good for that for the past decade and a half.
Slow-moving or fast-moving zombies?
I think fast-moving is scarier if you're in a hallway. Slow-moving is scarier for the world. Slow-moving zombies can always get into a fortress because it's not because they're clever, it's not because they're strong, it's because somebody always gets bit and then somebody else kindly lets that person in. It's always our own foibles that allow the slow zombies to walk over us.
Who have been some of your literary influences?
Philip K. Dick was an early one for me, the science fiction writer, and he still is a hero. I can't really read him when I'm writing something because he makes me wonder why I even try.
He has a Colorado connection, too.
He does, yes. And Louise Erdrich, she's an Anishinaabe writer. She has a way of dealing with family and the cycling through of generations that makes the world feel so textured and real. I really aspire to do something even half as good as she does.
So what scares you?
I think possession stories are terrifying. And, you know, I think it might come down to the fact that I'm Blackfeet. I'm American Indian. And the idea of being colonized in that manner just is fundamentally terrifying. It feels like history trying to repeat itself. I'm also terrified of people with dog heads. That's been my big fear ever since I was little. And so I wrote the werewolf novel Mongrels, and I've written lots of werewolf stories and just done a lot with werewolves trying to face that fear, I guess you could say. And then, you know, the past couple of years, I was talking to my mother. She had me when she was really young, and she says back then she had a big German Shepherd I never knew about. She would always come into my crib in my room, and my crib was low. She would find that big German Shepherd leaning over my crib growling at me. So she had to get rid of that dog. But I wonder if that's where my fear of dog-headed people came from.
I'm going to go with yes. A number of your books and stories have Native American themes and characters. How has your heritage influenced your writing?
You know, it influences my attitude mostly, I think. Like in that werewolf novel I'm talking about, Mongrels, the narrator mentions how every convenience store he walks in, the clerk knows he's a werewolf, and so they keep watching him in that mirror in the corner to make sure he's not going to steal anything, or really to track him and watch him when he does steal something. And because the clerk is so sure he's going to steal something, he thinks, I might as well do it. They think I'm guilty anyways. I might as well do it. Growing up, for me, in West Texas, as the only Blackfeet in West Texas, except for my family, that was also how it was for me. I was always guilty until proven otherwise. And I think that's how my being Blackfeet finds its way into the fiction. It's just me trying to push back against the world.
Who are your students, and how do they find their way into your class?
My students are generally writers. I would say 70% of them are looking into writing in a serious way. The others, right now I'm teaching a comic book course, and those students are not necessarily interested in writing. They're enthusiastic about comic books. And of the writing students, man, probably 8 out of 10 of them, maybe even 9 out of 10 of them these days, are pushing towards genre, towards fantasy, science fiction, horror, and maybe even westerns.
So a lot of your work has been what I would characterize as published traditionally, books, magazines, literary journals, and the publishing world is quite different now. Does that affect either how you teach or how your students write?
Once fiction became available digitally, everybody was scared the book was going to die, and that hasn't happened, of course. Ebook sales have been declining steadily ever since they popped up and became big. I don't think ebooks or digital reading has changed fiction or the way we tell stories, but I think audiobooks are starting to creep in, and they are having a change. I mean, when you hear a performance, you're hearing someone basically reading a script. And so I think there's going to be a tendency for novels to become more script-like and possibly have less fun with like homonyms and language, because that stuff doesn't translate if you're not reading it with your eyes. If you're only hearing it, it's a different experience. And I wonder if a book that is going to have a strong audio release if that writer is less compelled to try to establish a character's diction, because that can be taken up by the voice actor. They can do the accent.
Has any of that changed the way you teach?
Oh, it has changed the way I teach in that for a while I tried to use as my textbook to lead the class a digital version of a book, but digital versions of books, whether they're on an iPad or an e-ink reader or anything, they're not fast enough. They're not as fast as you need. You need to flip the pages in class and tell the kids, go to 272, now go to 119. And it's really hard to do that digitally.
Who's your favorite monster or why?
My favorite monster is the werewolf, generally. As for my favorite particular werewolf, that's going to be a guy named Eddie Quist from the movie The Howling from 1981. And the reason I like him is because he wanted to out werewolves. He wanted werewolves to be public, not private. He contacted a journalist, a television journalist, and transformed in front of her so that she could document it. And he wanted to force himself on the world, I guess. He wasn't a good guy. He was a really bad guy. But I liked his impulse a lot. I liked his drive.
What's coming up for you next? What are you working on?
Since April, I've written three novels, I guess. Two of them have been slashers. One of them is a haunted house novel, a babysitter haunted house novel. And my agent, just a week ago, I believe it was, she submitted the first of those novels that I wrote to publishers. And so it's sitting on a lot of editors' desks right now. It's called Elkhead Woman. And hopefully it'll be coming out next summer or so.
Why do some people gravitate toward a slasher?
I think with a slasher, what the audience connects with, and what I connect with anyways, is the development arc of the final girl. She starts out generally very withdrawn and bookish, very much a upstanding member of her community. And then when faced with this threat, she looks inside herself and finds a fighter. She finds someone who can take down Jason or Freddy or Michael or Leatherface or whoever. And she has the willpower, she wants to survive bad enough that she lets that secret self she's always had inside her out. And that transformation in the last like 10 minutes of a slasher, when she picks up that blade and turns the tables on the slasher and comes for him instead of being prey, I think that's a wonderful model for us all to follow. We should all stand up for ourselves and fight for ourselves and resist these bullies who are wearing masks and coming for us.
So from the outside of the horror genre looking in, how do you think you're viewed as a writer?
I think people understand that I'm very enthusiastic about horror, that I completely believe in it. I'm not just a dilettante. I'm not just touristing through. I'm here to stay. It's where I want to live in horror. So I connect with the fans. We're the black t-shirt crowd, you know, and we like being who we are.
You're a busy guy. And I wonder about the teaching part of it. You must love teaching.
I do. I really love engaging the students. Number one, they keep me connected to the world. I fear that without students, I would just drift away and listen to my old 8-tracks and and not ever know what's going on in the world. They force me to pay attention to things that I think I wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah? What's your favorite 8-track?
Oh, my favorite single 8-track, I think it's probably going to be Bob Seger, Nine Tonight. I think that's the first 8-track I remember.
Yeah,
when I was a kid.
One.
Yeah.
So the proverbial, you're stranded on a desert island. I'm going to be generous. I'm going to give you three books you could read for the rest of your time there. What would they
be? Yeah, I'm going to pick, first I'll pick a book that I haven't read because I think that's an important thing to do, is to read a new book. So I'm going to pick Alan Moore's novel Jerusalem, which is 1,100 pages of this comic book writer and novelist and filmmaker and kind of just commentator on the world, Alan Moore. Like, it's a tour through his head and his life, and I bet it's really interesting. I'm really anxious to get to that book. Another book I would take would be Neil Gaiman's Sandman series. That's like, I guess that's 5 volumes, so that's kind of
we'll
a cheat.
We'll give you that.
All right.
We're being generous.
It's 75 issues of a single title. And I just love the arc that the main character has there. It's just one of the best arcs that we've seen. And I would also take Stephen King's It, I believe.
Sounds like you'll be well occupied on that island. What made you think at some point in your life, I need to write a book?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess it happened. I was working on my doctorate at Florida State University. This is 1997. And I'm at a party with one of my dissertation director's editors. She was a big deal at a big five, or one of the big seven back then, I guess, publishers. And my dissertation director said, y'all two just speak among yourselves. And she left us there, and I felt stranded with this high-powered person. And I had this, like, out-of-body experience, and I saw myself telling her about this novel I'd written that was really good and wonderful and perfect and timeless and everything. And she said, you know, that sounds like exactly the kind of thing I'm looking to acquire. Why don't you send it over to me? And I said, you know, I just got to do one more polish across it, and then I'll blast it your way. And so then I went home that night, and I started that novel. And so that was my first time that I thought I've got to write a novel.
I was going to say, you made it sound so easy there, except for the writing part.
Yeah, yeah.
Professor Stephen Graham Jones, we really appreciate you joining us today on See You on the Air.
It was great talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us for See You on the Air. The University of Colorado comprises four campuses: Boulder, Colorado Springs, Denver, and the CU Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. To learn more about CU, go to www.cu.edu. Thanks to our producer, Kathy Buten, and audio engineer, John Arnold. I'm Ken McConnellog, and we'll see you on the air next month.
University of Colorado.